The 350th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society will fall on the 28th of November 2010, so it's still a few months away. And it's appropriate, therefore, that the whole year has seen a variety of activities celebrating this centenary, including a congratulatory volume edited by Bill Bryson, with contributions by various eminent scientists and others by way of celebration. I want to talk about the Society's early years because there's no doubt of the momentousness of the Society's foundation. This was a completely new type of institution, a publicly constituted body, national in its remit, which was devoted to the pursuit and promotion of scientific research. In retrospect, the role that the Society early came to play and the way in which it went about achieving this may seem almost self-evident, not least because it became the archetype of numerous comparable bodies that have followed in its footsteps over the intervening centuries. But in fact, it could be argued that the process by which the Society was set up and the way in which it developed in its early years wasn't at all as obvious as in retrospect it's easy to presume. Since no such body had existed before, it was necessary for a process of experiment, even of trial and error, to take place before the mode of operation emerged that was to prove so effective. And it's that process that I want to elucidate in what I say tonight, using the truly remarkable documentation that survives concerning the Society's early history. Even the Society's name may have surprised some of its early supporters. The somewhat establishmentarian title, which it has borne ever since, was first aired by John Evelyn in the dedication to a book published in 1661. But clearly, this was not the name that many had expected. In his notes on the Society in the immediate aftermath of its foundation, Elias Ashmole, the founder of this museum, left a blank after rather than before the word Society. Evidently, he expected it was going to be called the Society of Philosophers or something like that. And the result was that he subsequently had to go back later and write Royal, you know, insert Royal above the line, leaving the blank afterwards. It's still there. More striking is a further document associated with Evelyn. In this case, a sheet of paper in Evelyn's hand in which alternative coats of arms and mottos for the Society are noted. This must also date from about 1661. This shows that consideration was given to various alternatives to the blank shield quartered by the Royal Arms, which has been the Society's insignia ever since. Instead, it might have had something more allegorical or mystical. One possibility was a sun in splendour with the motto, "To the greater light," it's down at the bottom left. Another, a celestial globe juxtaposed with an all-seeing eye. Another, a hand holding a plumb line, possibly a Masonic symbol. While other designs had more directly scientific components, such as the one at the top right, showing a pair of cross telescopes and a constellation. The same is true of the epitaph Nullius in Verba that was adopted by the Society as its motto. This is a paraphrase of a passage in Horace's epistles affirming freedom from any master. The place of this might have been taken either by the Masonic sounding formula that I've already quoted, to the greater light, or a formula like omnia probate, possibly a suggestion of Evelyn's because it echoes his personal motto, omnia explorate. Or the quotation et orgebitur scientia from the Book of Daniel. This forms part of a slightly longer quotation about how many would run to and fro and knowledge should be increased in the last ages of the world. And it had inspired much millenarian speculation earlier in the 17th century, not least in the hands of Francis Bacon, whose vision for the collaborative pursuit of science itself formed part of the Society's intellectual origins. On the other hand, the establishmentarian coat of arms and title that were selected are themselves redolent of a key element in the Society's aspirations in its earliest years. And this was to an established corporate role, something that I've stressed in my book, Establishing the New Science, which came out in 1989. And many of the themes that I'm going to be exploring in this lecture are illustrated in much more detail in that book. In the years prior to the Society's foundation in 1660, there had been a widespread revulsion against the instability that had reached a climax with the Civil War, an aspiration to more stable forms of organisation, which is to be found both among supporters of the parliamentary regime and its opponents. This is epitomised by the setting up of bureaucratic governmental bodies such as the Council of Trade and Plantations, or by initiatives like Samuel Hartlib's Office of Address. And these reflect a clear sense that organised bodies were to be preferred to less formal ones, and public and bureaucratic structures were better than more personal initiatives. Linked to this was an ideal of permanence. This is also seen within a couple of decades of the foundation of the Royal Society in the foundation of this very museum in which we are tonight, because this was similarly established as an integral part of the University of Oxford to ensure that it would withstand the mutability that previous similar collections had been subject to. It's revealing that in Ashmole's negotiations with the university over the foundation of the museum, reference was made to what might happen to protect the bequest in the event of civil war or light commotions. The Royal Society was inspired by a similar wish to establish their institution to perpetuity. That's a quotation from an early document. And to this end, the founders of the Society went to extraordinary lengths to set up an elaborate constitutional structure in its earliest years, a structure that might almost seem top-heavy for such an infant body as the Society was. Having obtained a royal charter in 1662, which gave the Society a status comparable to the legally incorporated bodies like the Chartered Companies of the City of London, the Society then had acquired a second charter just a year later in 1663, and this cost them £53.07 and 8p, in addition to the £35.10 that they paid on the first charter. So a lot of money was invested in these constitutional initiatives. And the reason for replacing the first charter by the second was that various details of the body's constitutional structure were set out more clearly in the second than had been in the case in the first, notably concerning the quora for decision-making and elections. There were also elaborate statutes which went into detail about how fellows and officers were to be elected, about what the duties of the officers should be, about how meetings were to be held and how the Society's work should be conducted, even about how those who failed to work for the good of the Society might, if necessary, be expelled. This was all spelt out within 2 years of the Society's foundation. Between them, these documents provided for a complex and highly sophisticated institution. The Society was governed by a council of 21, elected annually, including a president, a treasurer, and two secretaries, all of whom swore an oath on appointment. Election was by secret ballot and required a formal proposal. Once elected, fellows were obliged to pay an admission fee and an annual subscription. The charter also entitled the Society to employ staff, to own property, to erect a college or colleges, to sue and be sued in the courts, and to appoint its own printer and license its own books. There was also elaborate provision for the records which the Society expected to keep, including a statute book containing all these documents, along with journal books, register books, and letter books. Indeed, these were evidently intended to be housed in a special chest that was bought for the Society and which still survives and can be seen at the Royal Society. There was also clearly an expectation in these very earliest years that the society might expect an endowment to match its established status, which, in the words of a letter requesting such funds, would help to promote the public concerns of a society whose designs, if protected and assisted by authority, may so much conduce to the greatness and honour of their prince, the real good of his dominions, and the universal benefit of mankind. These grandiose ambitions are well encapsulated in the frontispiece to the official history of the body, commissioned from the writer Thomas Spratt and published in 1667, in which the goddess Fame crowns a bust of Charles II, who is flanked by the Society's first president, William Viscount Brunker, and Francis Bacon in his robes as Lord Chancellor. Above is the Society's coat of arms and motto prominently displayed. And in addition, if you look carefully in front of the bookcase to the left, you can see the Society's diploma or charter and its statutes and journal book, along with the rather grand silver gilt mace that Charles II presented to the Society and which it still possesses. What's more, the Society's intellectual ambitions seem to have matched these overarching institutional ones, as is perhaps indicated on the Spratt frontispiece by the plethora of examples of scientific equipment, which can be seen in the background, and the books on related subjects in the bookcase, the titles of some of which can just be discerned. What is remarkable about the expressions of its aims that came from the Society in its earliest years, including what Spratt said in his history, is a breathtaking emphasis on completeness, comprehensiveness as its goal. In order to know what was already known and what still required investigation, the Society planned to scrutinise all books previously written on relevant topics as a means of collecting all the phenomena of nature hitherto observed and all philosophical experiments hitherto made and recorded. Such grandiose ambitions applied to technology as well as science, in the Society's hope to compile a full-scale history of trades in which industrial and technical processes would be surveyed and improved. Here is an example here's an illustration from an example of such a history, in this case a description by Robert Hooke, the Society's first curator of experiments, of the manner of making salt at a saltern in Hampshire. In his history, Spratt explained how their purpose is, in short, to make faithful records of all the works of nature and art that can come within their reach. And this grandiloquence about the comprehensive scale of the Society's plans was repeatedly echoed. Thus, in his profuse correspondence promoting the Society and its aims, the First Secretary, Henry Oldenburg, repeatedly gave voice to sentiments of a similar kind. "It is our business in the first place," he wrote in 1663, "to scrutinise the whole of nature and to investigate its activity and powers by means of observation and experiments, and then in course of time to hammer out a more solid philosophy and more ample amenities of civilisation." He explained in a letter to John Winthrop in Connecticut in 1667, "Sir, you will please to remember that we have taken to task the whole universe, and that we were obliged to do so by the nature of our design." This is also seen in another of the Society's aspirations in its early years, to a museum of objects that would be complete. Robert Hooke wanted as full and complete a collection of all varieties of natural bodies as could be obtained, while Spratt described a general collection of all the effects of arts and the common or monstrous works of nature as one of the principal intentions of the Society as soon as they were reduced into a fixed assembly. And I think that juxtaposition of institutionalisation with these comprehensive ambitions is significant in itself. He added that by the time he wrote, they had already drawn together into one room the greatest part of all the several things that are scattered throughout the universe. And from about this time, we begin to learn something of the kind of objects that the collection contained, as seen in this illustration of a hawfinch Cocothraustes vulgaris, illustrated from the specimen in the Society's Museum in a book published in 1668. This went with a presumption that the Society would actually test everything for itself. The collective testimony of the membership was seen as a key part of the process by which knowledge would be validated. Spratt emphasised how experimental findings were to be examined in the presence of the Society as a corporate body, who observed all the chances and regularities of the proceeding, never giving it over till the whole company has been fully satisfied of the certainty and constancy, or on the other side, of the absolute impossibility of the effect. In fact, it's clear that institutionalisation gave a strong impulse to the kind of inductive, accumulative view of science that had been challenged a generation earlier by Francis Bacon, in contrast to the more deductive approaches of some of his contemporaries. And this is something which is also seen in other comparable bodies set up in these years, such as the Académie des Sciences in Paris, founded in 1666. In fact, in the case of the French Academy, which had a more exclusive membership than was the case with the English one, which was relatively open, it's interesting that when a choice was being made as to who should be allowed to join the new body, a conscious effort was made to avoid Cartesians who would make it into an empty talk shop. As it was, the French Academy, almost more than the English, made a virtue of collaborative experiment, and even published these findings jointly in volumes with titles like Memoirs to Serve for a Natural History of Animals and Plants by the members of the Royal Academy of Sciences. And here I display one of the elaborate plates which these official publications of the Académie des Sciences contained, showing this corporate investigation in action, which I think give you a real sense of how 17th century science was done. Sadly, we lack such visual records of the activity of the Royal Society in its early years. Returning to the Royal Society, I think what was equally characteristic was the Society's tendency to delegate specific responsibilities to committees, corporate subsets of the Society's overall institutional structure. Committees were set up from the outset to deal with matters like correspondence or the compilation of inquiries to be sent throughout the known world to gather information. And when, in 1664, the Society began to find that it was asking too much for the whole of knowledge to be reformed at its weekly meetings, the reaction was to set up 8 specialist committees dealing with different aspects of its work, from astronomy and optics to anatomy and chemistry, and from mechanical inventions to trades and agriculture. These committees had a fixed membership which was recorded in a scroll, which unfortunately no longer survives, to which alterations were recorded in the Society's minutes. And also minutes were kept of their meetings for a period. Here are the minutes of one of these committees, this one responsible for perusing travel books in search of useful information which would further the Society's goal of acquiring nature of the whole known world. So those were the plans, but in practice, these rather grandiose ambitions proved more than the Society could sustain. And what I think is particularly interesting about the early history of the Society is the way in which the Society settled into a somewhat different set of roles to those which it had initially envisaged, but these nevertheless proved highly effective. The specialist committees soon fell by the wayside. The minutes like this only survived for a few months, while the ambition to comprehensiveness was also abandoned. In the case of the Society's museum, some had from the outset laughed at it as too voluminous to have ducks, geese and hen, etc. Instead, the collection tended to specialise in the exotic, leaving the study of common objects to other contexts. And it was in this form that it was commemorated when a catalogue was published by Nehemiah Grew in 1681 as Museum Regalis Societatis, Here is the title page with the facing portrait of Daniel Colwell, who had been the collection's chief benefactor in its early years when he had bought up an entire cabinet of exotica, formerly owned by Virtuoso, which continued to dominate the museum's content at the point when this catalogue was published. The history of trades, the society's technological plan, similarly proved overambitious and achieved successes only in selected areas. For instance, concerning forestry, the subject of John Evelyn's silver. Silver originated as a corporate initiative on the part of the society, in fact, yet another committee. And this, again, was how the technological programme was forwarded. But increasingly, Evelyn himself took responsibility for revising the various editions into which the book went during his lifetime. Even in terms of corporate experiment, a realisation is in evidence that a focus was needed if the society's activities were not to be so generalised as to be counterproductive. As a result, there were repeated attempts to introduce a more systematic approach to the society's work. Initially seen in the programme for a series of experiments on pneumatics, produced by Robert Hooke when he was appointed the society's first curator of experiments in November 1662, and then repeatedly echoed in reform efforts in the society's early years. For instance, on the 4th of December 1666, there was a discussion as to how the experiments at the public meetings of the society might be best carried on, whether by a continuous series of experiments, taking in collateral ones as they were offered, or by going on in that promiscuous way which had hitherto obtained. And at later occasions too, decisions were made to try to prosecute a single topics as the chief work of the society's meetings. There was also a marked change in the nature of the society's activity in its early years, in the form of a decline in the amount of actual experimentation that was carried out at the society's meetings, and a rise in the extent to which these meetings were taken up by reports and discussions of research done elsewhere. A key function for the society, but one which seems to have occupied a rather secondary position in the priorities of the society's founders, who anticipated a frenetic programme of experimentation in its own right. Whereas in 1664, reportage and the reading of correspondence each occupied a place in the society's business about equivalent to that of actual experimentation, by 1680, six times as much time was devoted to listening to results as to generating them, so a complete shift in the balance of the society's activities. This statistic I derive from some important quantitative work on the society's minutes that was done some years ago by the American scholar Robert G. Frank Jr., which perhaps deserves more attention than it's received. This trend was repeatedly bewailed by the society's organisers, who often sought to reverse it. But it could be argued that this was precisely the area where the society could be most effective, not so much in actually doing research as in arbitrating it. In other words, the society acquired a key significance as a forum where research done or observations made elsewhere were reported, discussed, and evaluated, thus meaning that the corporate appraisal remained crucial, but at one removed from the actual process of scientific discovery. Indeed, although this role had only been peripherally foreseen by the society's founders when they initially set the institution up, this was one of the functions for which it was best equipped. It was almost as if the men who founded the society had been right to see the value of a corporate structure, but had to learn what functions it could most effectively serve. And this role was not limited to scientists in this country. Instead, it gave the society a truly international status. From an early stage, the society was called on to assess and adjudicate scientific findings from all over Europe as with the conflicting observations of the course of the comet in 1665, made by Johann Hevelius in Danzig and Adrian Ozu in Paris. And later, the Society was to accredit and promote the research of such scientists as Antony von Leeuwenhoek and from Holland, and Marcello Malpighi from Italy. Leeuwenhoek used the Society to publish virtually all his microscopic findings, and the result is that the Society's archive is the chief repository of the delicate drawings of his microscopical observations that he compiled. This example shows a magnified cross-section of a oak stem, which was sent to the Society in 1675. And this role of, as it were, accreditation was equally important for lesser men, as was beautifully expressed by one French savant who explained to Henry Oldenburg in a letter in 1668, "If I should be so happy as to deserve your approval, I should thereby expect to obtain that of all the citizens of the Republic of Letters. Since in order to judge physical works properly, one must be of your opinion and of that represented by that illustrious and celebrated Royal Society, which is known to all learned men as the first of those which have been created in imitation of it." Associated with this was an equally significant process of accreditation and demarcation. The Society had a key role in deciding who to take seriously and who to ignore. Some of those who contacted the Society were quietly discouraged, such as the German savant Eckhard Leichner, who wrote in about his apodictical method for solving all the problems of religion and philosophy, and was quietly but firmly informed that this was not the sort of thing that the Society went in for. The Society was also in a position to define the norms of scientific communication, emphasising the value of sober reportage and restraint from speculation, but at the same time showing a receptiveness to novel hypotheses if these were properly founded. Here we encounter the stress on matters of fact, on which emphasis has been laid by certain recent historians. In fact, it's even been claimed that Isaac Newton adapted his findings concerning light when he reported them to the Society in the early 1670s in order to give the impression that they derived from discrete experiments of which he gave circumstantial reports, although this in fact misrepresented the actual process by which he arrived at his findings. Related to this was the question of what subjects were considered within the Society's remit, which had a crucial, if hardly foreseen, function, namely of defining the boundaries of what constituted science as a discipline. Centering on natural and mechanical problems, but extending through the life sciences towards medicine and through chemistry and applied mathematics towards technology. Interestingly, one corollary was to exclude subjects like magic, which, although of great interest to some fellows, was frowned on by others. The result was that the Society simply ignored occult-tinged pursuits, and this helped to demarcate the boundaries of science in a crucial, if negative, manner, which I think had a major unsuspected impact at the time. So here too, the Society more or less consciously discovered roles which had not really been foreseen when it was constituted, but which yet were to prove highly crucial. The Society also had to learn how best to achieve its goals within such resources as were at its disposal. And here again, a rather brutal process of education had to occur, as the Society's early hopes of lavish endowment were disillusioned, and it found itself subsisting on the modest income provided by the subscriptions of its fellows, each of whom had to pay 52 shillings a year. One casualty was the idea of the Society having its own purpose-built premises, a project which nearly materialised in 1667-8, when the Society sought contributions for a college or research institute on the banks of the Thames, And these contributions were itemised in a lavish vellum-bound volume which still survives in the Society's archive and which I reproduce here. In the event, the contributions proved so disappointing that the plan was abandoned, and London was therefore never graced with the purpose-built Baroque Scientific Institute on the banks of the Thames that it might have had, possibly to be designed by Christopher Wren. Even the scale of the Society's activities was subject to such constraints. Since the institution could only ever afford a handful of paid employees on its modest income. Yet, such employees as it had proved crucial, notably the first secretary, Henry Oldenburg, and the first curator of experiments, Robert Hooke. Arguably, these two men did more to define the corporate ethos of the Society than anyone else. Hooke in terms of the Society's experimental programme, and Oldenburg in terms of its public role, as reflected first in his profuse correspondence, and then in the printed spin-off from that, which he inaugurated in 1665 in the form of Philosophical Transactions, of which this is the very first number. Once invented, the Philosophical Transactions quickly came to fulfil a role previously barely noticed, namely, but which proved crucial, namely as a convenient register for the bringing in and preserving many experiments which, not enough for a book, would else be lost. In other words, this was a further means of recording and validating scientific research and stimulating cognate investigations for which the Society can take responsibility. Oldenburg was thus responsible for the chief agencies by which the processes of arbitration and accreditation that I've just referred to were actually implemented. Yet typically, the Society had initially presumed that correspondence would best be dealt with by yet another committee, and it was only in practice that it discovered that the function was more effectively carried out by dedicated work on the part of a single individual in the form of Oldenburg. So here again we see this process of education in the Society's early years that I've been illustrating throughout this talk. In fact, Oldenburg handled more than 300 incoming and outgoing letters a year, quite apart from publishing Philosophical Transactions and keeping the Society's minutes, and he arguably deserves to be celebrated almost more than anyone else for his role in achieving what the Society achieved in its early years. Yet, what is important to stress is that for all Oldenburg's personal significance, and I think that the late A.R. and M.B. Hall, I think, demonstrated that clearly, for all his personal significance, this depended on a symbiosis between his activity individually and the corporate role of the Society. Oldenburg was at pains to explain to his correspondents how he had read out their letters at meetings of the Society. And the arbitration that then occurred was a corporate step taken by the fellows as a body, of which Oldenburg was merely a reporter. For all the significance of individuals like Oldenburg, this was only effective in conjunction with the corporate activity of the Society as a whole, which transcended the role of individuals even while taking advantage of it to achieve the Society's goals. Indeed, another key facet of the Society in its early years was its voluntary nature, the way in which it was made up of a large and diffuse membership, as illustrated by this rather interesting early manuscript list of the Society's members compiled in 1663, which divides them up by social status. But more familiarly, by the printed lists that were produced every year in the Society's early history. These were intended partly as ballot papers for the annual elections of the officers and council, but they also had the effect of propagating knowledge of the Society and the distinguished makeup of its membership. In fact, due to the profuse survival of the Society's records, we know a great deal about its fellows in its early years, to the extent of knowing who paid their subscriptions or spoke at meetings or otherwise helped to support the Society's corporate endeavours, as also who lost interest almost as soon as they joined and had to be expelled in purges of the membership in which the Society indulged from time to time in its early years. What's apparent from studying and analysing the membership is that the society was sustained by a core of between 30 and 50 committed supporters who stuck to the institution through thick and thin, often serving as council members or officers, and many of them showing a striking longevity, so that some of those who had joined the society in its very earliest years were still active in 1700. A number of these were figures who are well known retrospectively for their scientific or other credentials, such as Robert Hooke or John Evelyn. But others are less well known figures, like Sir John Hoskins or Abraham Hill. What's striking is that this cadre seems to have formed an ambitious, knowledgeable, and effective team with a significance as a group which transcends the significance of its individual membership and which can be seen as responsible for the society's corporate initiatives in its early years. Obviously, its members were not unanimous in their views. In fact, another facet of the rich documentation associated with the society in its early years is that we can actually eavesdrop on some of the debates that took place as to how the society's goals were best achieved, particularly in relation to attempts to improve the society's efficiency and reform its workings that took place in the late 1660s and the 1670s. Not all were convinced that the purpose-built premises planned in 1667-8 was as good an idea as those who were protagonists of the scheme. An example of this is provided by the canny John Wallis, Professor of Geometry at Oxford, who commented in a letter to Oldenburg, "I wish your building good success, but cannot promise that I shall here, at Oxford, be able to get you subscriptions toward it, nor do I presume to deliver my opinion of the design, knowing so little of it, but take for granted, so many wise men see very good reason to undertake it and ways how to get it perfected." A real sort of vote of no confidence. Equally revealing was the comment of another fellow, Samuel Pepys, who, although he subscribed himself, noted how several I saw hang off, and I doubt it will spoil the society, for it breeds faction and ill will, and becomes burdensome to some that cannot or would not do it. Divergent views also became apparent in the debates as to how the society's goals might best be achieved in the early 1670s. And from this period, some extraordinary records survive, including discussion papers by leading fellows, notably one by a fellow who annoyingly identified himself only as A.B., who showed a very shrewd grasp of the society's shortcomings and its goals, and who was particularly concerned about the society's public image or reputation and how this might be improved. From this period, we even have evaluative lists of the society's members compiled for the benefit of those trying to plan the institution's future, in which those fellows who were deemed indispensable were separated out from those who were not, thus complementing the evidence from the accounts and the minutes as to who contributed how much to the society. Documents like these are revealing in themselves, but it's also interesting that on the whole, such discussions seem to have tended to strengthen the society rather than to weaken it, to enhance its resolve effectively to pursue the goals for which it had been founded in the first place. And this meant this corporate identity of the society and this sort of corporate effort meant that the society had a striking resilience when its lack of state support placed it in a vulnerable position, as was the case on more than one occasion in its early decades. Contrary to the view of some who have adopted a kind of great man theory of institutional history, the society was not saved from these crises in its early years by the intervention of the likes of Sir Christopher Wren or Sir Isaac Newton. If anything, some of the over-decisive individual initiatives in which Newton indulged during his presidency may have done more harm to the society than good. Instead, the institutional structure that the founders inaugurated had a real staying power as they had intended. They may have been naive in some of their initial hopes and plans, and may have had to learn by experience the functions that such an institution could most usefully serve. But that doesn't, I think, in any way reduce our debt to them for their prescience in seeing the need for an institution of the kind that they conceived and brought to fruition, and for giving it the overall institutional shape that has proved so resilient ever since. Thank you.
Michael, not only was that full of interesting content, it was valiant in its perseverance through whatever.
Sorry about that.
No, at all. Admirable. I haven't actually, he's going to be valiant again, because I haven't actually cleared the possibility of questions with Michael, but I'm sure he would. He would be curious if there are any. Which are. Yes?
You said the society avoided the occult and magic. What was the attitude towards alchemy at that time within the science, so philosophical world? Was you coming from the transition to chemistry proper in not too distant future?
Well, people like Newton and Boyle were very active alchemists, but the interesting thing is that these matters are hardly discussed at all at the society's meetings, and certainly they're not overtly discussed. And the same is true of other sort of occult pursuits, astrology, witchcraft, things like that, that although some fellows are quite interested in these privately, in terms of the public, the society's corporate records, there is a complete blank. And I think that by the early 18th century, people had come to feel that these did not belong, and that that was very significant in itself, although I think it wasn't really planned at all, except in the negative way of, you know, not wanting to talk about things on which there was a lot of disagreement among fellows.
So I could ask a question about, you didn't mention clubs at all. I wonder how you view the club.
Clubs within the society.
Yes. I mean, were they an expression of collegiality and friendliness, or were they a sort of were they factional, and did they reflect discontent rather than identity?
I think that the major growth of clubs is later. Is
later. Yeah. But
the one exception is Hooke, and I think Hooke is the one person who, I mean, when I deliberately put in the words when I was saying that on the whole the disagreements didn't seem to lead to factionalism. I deliberately put in the words on the whole, because I think the one example of someone who did do that is Hooke setting up separate coffee house clubs in the late 1670s, which I think if that had become a common occurrence, I think it would have been disastrous. But in fact, once Oldenburg was out of the way and Hooke could take over the society himself, that evaporates and he reverts to being active in the society in its own right. But I think there may be certain sort of contingencies, some bits of good luck almost about the society's development, which I've slightly skated over in the course of what I see as being, you know, really sort of positive developments that took place. But I think perhaps one could also give some place to luck, and that in a case like that, that if there had been more deep factionalism, that could have been disastrous. Interestingly, A.B., this person who wrote this very interesting discussion paper about the society in the early 1670s, was worried about expelling members on the grounds that that might lead to sort of backbiting, which could be damaging to the society, and thought it might be better just to sort of let things be and let, you know, members who were no use just stay on the list. But in fact, the society did go ahead with that, and it doesn't seem to have had the outcome that he thought. So people were aware of that at the time.
The distinguishing characteristic of science is experiment. And I'm just wondering, to what extent was that common knowledge at the time that they just plucked out, or did they actually invent the idea of experiment as being the distinguishing?
Well, I did. I mean, I think that people like Boyle did, and the society reflects that. And clearly the idea of a sort of carefully reported conclusive experiment is central to the sort of the method of science in this period. But so yes, that's absolutely central to the Royal Society's ethos. But I think what has to be learned, as I was explaining, is that you can't expect to do them all in the society. And in fact, in a way, it becomes slightly trivialised within the society, because it degenerates almost from experiments being done in the society in order to prove or disprove a hypothesis, as it were, to just retrospective demonstrations of things that have been done elsewhere. And I think that's what comes to the fore as you go into the 18th century, of experiments put on almost for entertainment, almost, but as demonstrations of findings that have already been found out elsewhere. But I mean, the society is absolutely committed that experimental demonstration is the way in which knowledge is produced and proved.
And is that new at the time, that idea?
Yes, I mean, the idea of...
How far back does that go, the central activity of science as experiment?
Well, in terms of, as it were, a sort of discrete, controlled experiment, I think it is new. That, I mean, Aristotle and the Aristotelians and scientists coming from that tradition use the idea of a sort of demonstration, but it's always in a very sort of generalised sense, and in a way, specific instances of showing that something works were not seen as very significant, because by definition they were specific and not general. And so the idea, you know, that you prove knowledge by doing an exact repeatable experiment, and that provided a better form of knowledge than the sort of the deductive systems of the past, is sort of the characteristic of the mid-17th century, yes. And the society, and the Royal Society, is absolutely close, absolutely linked to that.
Yes, there's a question over there.
Yeah. I think when you're talking about members and fellows, that's what, that's the same. And I just wonder, could anybody become a member at that stage?
Yes, I mean, the strict term is fellow in the Latin charter, it's socius, but I mean, obviously what it means is member. Well, it was quite an elaborate process to become a fellow. You had to be proposed, and you then had to be elected. And there are people known who were proposed and failed to achieve election. And also, there was clearly quite a degree of a sense of who were the right sort of people to be proposed and elected. And they're mostly people of professional status. There are relatively few craftsmen and artisans. So in a sense, it was rather sort of self-selecting, you know, that it tended to replicate itself. There was one period in the society's early years when a London tradesman, John Houghton, became a fellow, and he deliberately seems to have tried to get more similar people to himself into the membership, and this seems to have led to a bit of a sort of backlash against him, and it then reverted to it being dominated by professionals, you know, doctors, obviously people of leisure, people, government, people in government, things like that. I mean, that's very much the nature of the early fellowship, and that's where my sort of core group of sort of the 30 to 50 through who sustained the society through its early years come from. They're government ministers, courtiers, landed gentlemen, doctors, people like that.
You talk about the charter. I was just wondering the extent to which that was evolutionary from other organisations, and to what extent it was novel.
Well, it was the first research institution to have a charter. But I mean, universities obviously had had charter. I mean, you know, any public in any chartered body had to have a charter. And I've never actually looked. I mean, I I suppose one could actually have looked at the wording and see if it was almost a sort of, you know, an adapted version of a type of charter that was also given to other comparable bodies. I just don't know about that, actually, to be honest. But, you know, for instance, the College of Physicians had a charter, but that was much older. You'd need to find newly chartered bodies dating from around 1660, and that would be quite an interesting exercise, but I confess I haven't done it.
Can I ask something else? You said at the start that even the name was in doubt at the start, and I thought you were thinking of the first part of the name, you know, the Royal Society, and of course the royal patronage was much desired and not forthcoming, and I was thinking that the. As you ended thinking about the longevity and so on of the institutions of the society, whether on the whole that hadn't been a benefit, that thinking about some of the societies that existed under say, the patronage of the Medici, you know, had not developed robust institutions to sustain themselves in the way the Royal Society had. So I thought I would sort of challenge you by asking, now, was the king's absence in the end beneficial to the society?
Well, the king sort of he's the king is ambivalent, isn't he? But I think particularly in the context of restoration, I think it is important for it to be have a royal patronage. I mean, I think for it to have been lacking a royal patronage would have been problematic in it being seen as a part of the establishment it wanted to be. But you're right, I mean, on the other hand, if the king had interfered too much, that could have been a problem. I mean, Louis XIV was much more hands-on with the Académie des Sciences, and I'm not sure that the sort of initiatives that he wanted were necessarily good for it.
In the stories that are always told about the Charles sneering and so on, yeah. You think that isn't typical, really? That's just the sort of story that gets remembered.
There is this. There's this story that he joked about the fact that they spent their time weighing air. I think he could see the point of what they were doing on the whole. Yes. Although I have to say, I mean, you know, Charles II is a very difficult person to understand. You know, I think almost everyone who's trying to write about Charles II is left very unclear what he really believed in, etc. And I'm not sure I have terribly good evidence that he took it all that seriously, to be honest.
I was very struck by the comment about the changing balance of the business of meetings and the way that this receiving of correspondence and discussion becomes so predominant after the first few years. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder whether that has any impact on the kind of topics that they can best deal with. Because if you're receiving personal letters from virtuosi in the salon around Europe, and they're offering claims and new announcements and things like that, it's easy to discuss that and to arbitrate between them. Mm. But if they were wanting to pursue, say, the history of trades, that's not going to fit into that sort of, you know, submission and discussion and adjudication between claims. Do you think there's anything, any merit in thinking about how that might have...
I don't know, really. I mean, I would have thought actually you can have a discussion of almost anything that's read out or recirculated. I mean, obviously with an experiment or something sort of hands on to have a demonstration of it would help. But I'm not sure. I think you could be right that it might have affected. I mean, some things might have been more engrossing than others. I mean, there are certainly some things that you can have a report on and a discussion of that you couldn't possibly do yourself, like hearing about how technical practices are done in India or something like that, or, you know, hearing about exotic phenomena in completely different parts of the world. So in that sense, it might have encouraged more of that kind of reportage, it seems to me that you can report on a lot of things that you could actually have done as well.
But there's never a
an interest or the possibility of adjudicating on new technical processes, saying that someone says, you know, I've got this new writing in, I've got this new way of doing it, you know, I'd like it to be sort of authorised.
Yeah, I think that technology proved difficult for all sorts of other reasons too, not least that it was at, you know, that kind of arbitration was so sensitive in technology that it was actually a very difficult area for the society to be active in, even if it had wanted to be. And I think there are repeated failures in attempts to take initiatives technologically because of the sheer difficulty of really sort of working out what really works and what doesn't. And the society, I think, tends to back off and stick to pure science because, in a way, that's easy.
Perhaps, yeah.
Here's
please.
Thank you. I wanted to, it's a sort of related point, to do, you were saying about the sober reportage that they emphasised, that the society emphasised. Did they give explicit guidelines on how things should be written? I'm very interested in the movement from experiment to writing about experiment. Were there explicit guidelines given? How they should,
I think Oldham's. Yeah, I mean, no one writes a sort of style manual, but I think Oldenburg. If you carefully read Oldenburg's letters to some people with whom he corresponded at some length, he does seem to be giving clear indications of what kind of reportage he prefers. I mean, it's often just by being quite effusive when he gets what he wants, and not so effusive when he doesn't. But I'm not sure I'm not quite sure how explicit you'd expect it to be, but I think it might be slightly disappointing if you were looking for something, you know, as open, as overt as that.
Perhaps one last question from Howard then.
Yeah, Oldenburg's centrality to the Royal Society as it evolved after a few years was clearly borne out by your account. And I'd be interested in your sense of how much of that was his initiative in response to the situation in which the evolving society found itself, and how much of that role was envisaged, you know, by the early founders. Was that, as it were, an unexpected development, or was that something which really anticipated more or less from the outset?
Well, I mean, the statutes do talk about correspondence, they refer to correspondence, but they don't refer to it very much compared with experiment, for instance. And now that I think about it in relation to you, it being you who asked the question, I mean, considering what people at the time must have known about the scale of correspondence of people like Hartley relatively recently in this country, or Messen in France a generation earlier, correspondence could actually have been higher on the agenda in the initial institutional structure than it was. And so I think that, in a way, it was something that Oldenburg just proved to be very good at, and that took on its own momentum from that. And I think, I mean, as I say, I can't go as far as to say that correspondence isn't even mentioned in those early documents, because it is. But it clearly, you know, they just refer in passing to the society getting letters, but that's rather different from the scale of activity that Oldenburg indulged in. And I think that it just grew because he was good at it, and the society found it worked, and, you know, that it gave the society kudos, it was good for the development of knowledge, etc. And I think it was just almost spontaneous.
Well, we really ought to release Michael. It's been a lively night in Broad Street. I think we were right to eschew the circus in the street or the champagne on the top floor. I think we've chosen the better part. So come and listen to Michael and spend the night. Thank you very much.